Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we have another show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, some science. You know, I throw all that stuff in there. And I thought it would be appropriate because of some historical things that have taken place that we talk about the crisis in Tibet. And for those of you who are unaware of what's been going on there, I want to mention that this is the week of the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the, we'll call it, the revolt, the nonviolent revolt by the Tibetan people about 9 years after they tried to reach an agreement with the communist Chinese government around the sometime in 1950. And the crisis is really one of both genocide and, boy, I don't even know the word for it, but it's the similar kind of thing, destruction of someone's religion. Religious side? I don't know if that's a word. Okay. Well, at any rate, you could call it and feed into this whole mess I'm doing right now before I go any further and put my foot in my mouth further. By dialing 877-876-5227 if you are in the U.S. and if you're in Canada. You can dial 888-815-9756. Again, we're talking about the crisis in Tibet and what that's all about. I'm going to give some historical stuff, which I already started to do a little bit, and I'm going to also give my opinions. Again, my opinions are just that. They do not necessarily mean that they are accurate, true, or anything like that. I'll try to be somewhat correct about the historical issues, but anything I say about what should have been or what will be is, of course, what I think. But you can also tell me what you think as well. Okay, let's go on. So, yeah, there's been genocide or killing the religion of the Tibetan people, which is Tibetan Buddhism, for those of you who are unfamiliar with that word. What is Tibetan Buddhism? Well, Tibetan Buddhism is a kind of Buddhism that is both the practice as well as the, we'll say, the learning and understanding of the teachings of Buddha. Well, that kind of makes sense if you're going to call it Buddhism, right? And it's more than some religions are in terms of practice. I mean, some people say, how is it compared to like Zen Buddhism? Well, Zen is kind of like this erudite type of Buddhism that is more head trippy and more about not doing things. Now, again, this is my opinion. If you're a Zen Buddhist, you're probably ready to pick up the phone and call me. But that's how I see it. And if you're a Chinese Buddhist, of which you're probably today in great mortal danger, but at any rate, if you believe in Buddhism and you live in China proper, now China now has declared Tibet China as well, but if you were before into Chinese Buddhism, you probably kept more into the realm of dealing with the society through in your world through the aspects of the monastery and the aspects of living within one and being a monk within one or being a nun within one. Yeah, they even have nuns. Some people don't know that. They have nuns. Okay, so that's pretty much the way it is for those kinds of Buddhists, and there's all kinds of Buddhists. There's Southeastern Asian Buddhists that are different than the Chinese or the Zen, which tend to be hanging around somewhere in Japan and other places like that. So these days, anyway. So if you were into Buddhism in Tibet, that's a different thing, and I'm going to tell you why. You see, the Tibetans, in tradition for hundreds and hundreds of years, maybe going back nearly a millennia, have been living more of Buddhism, and it became more part of their whole society and therefore they applied it. It's an application of the views and teachings of Buddha in a societal means, more so than many other Buddhisms have been. And that makes it very interesting, because I said it's religious side, because part of what's been going over the crisis in Tibet is kind of the combining of killing off, torturing, imprisoning, burning to the ground, destroying in many other ways, all the monasteries and nunneries and all that stuff, and destroying the religion by appointing a fake head of the religion. Now, it sounds bizarre. I mean, most people today would say, well, who's going to buy into that? I mean, you know, there's this guy named the Dalai Lama. Isn't he the head of the religion? No, not if you live in Tibet right now. No, because the Chinese government decided to pick somebody else who lived kind of in China or one of the provinces next to China that is going to be the head, the Dalai Lama of Tibetan Buddhism. And that happened a long time ago. Because they said, well, he left. He went to India, so he left all you guys. So we'll just put somebody else in. And he's the guy that you're gonna find is gonna tell you what to do. Yeah, it's a convenient thing if you think about it, because it kind of makes it so that the religion is gonna say exactly what you want it to say. The problem with that is that there's a lineage issue, because Buddhism follows the concept, as you know I do too, of reincarnation. And there's a belief that that each lama is reincarnated, not the Dalai Lama per se, each lama, each head of a potential group, usually connected to a monastery in Tibet at least, is a lineage going back to a predecessor. The Dalai Lama is a predecessor of Buddha. Doesn't mean that the Dalai Lama is a reincarnation of Buddha. That gets confusing. I know that sounds strange. That's where things get really touchy. Some people believe that, by the way. I don't think that that's what it's supposed to mean, and it depends on who you're talking to, what it really means. But it may mean that the Dalai Lama is a reincarnation of one of Buddha's students, okay? And that student keeps coming back being the head of all the monasteries, and including the government in Tibet, because this is a government that applies most of the Buddhic teachings to how it semi-governs to some extent in the past. This is now, we're talking about before 1950, obviously. Okay, so this is the Buddhism we're talking about. This is the Tibet we're talking about before 1950. It was a place where, if you were to go there, you would find people who were trying to live predominantly by the teachings of Buddha. Does that mean that they didn't allow anybody else to have any other religion? No, they were extremely tolerant. You could come there, and if you wanted to be some other religion, that's okay. That was fine. There was no, you know, like, oh, gee, you aren't one of us, so we're going to, you know, go after you. Because this, one of the teachings of this religion is extreme tolerance and acceptance of others' positions being not necessarily antithetical and destructive to others, that you can have different ways of thinking, different ways of practicing religion or having a religion. You can have all of these things and still find compassion and love for others and an attempt to live a life that is virtuous and that follows what was the construct of Buddha's understanding of a great being, we'll say. But in his construct, God was not necessarily a being per se as we perceive a being. God was part of all that is good. And there wasn't as much personification of God as a person, I mean. But that's another question that's open for debate and maybe different than some people may think, and that's okay, because this is just how they thought and how they still think. So what is the crisis then? We have this crisis. It started about 1949, 1950. The communist Chinese were coming to power in China. They were beating Chiang Kai-shek, a guy who was kind of, we'll say, a kind of shady capitalist fellow who was running the imperial army and was saying, I'm going to take over China. But he was also kind of a turkey, because he was an opportunist. He really didn't care much about the masses of people. He was more into the wealthy, into the elite. And the people rebelled against him. They didn't like him more than they didn't like, at least in 1947, 48, 49, the Chinese, the Red Chinese, who were, of course, communists. And they had been fighting for 20-some-odd years before that. So basically, you had a long period of time in which these Red Chinese have been running around trying to convince everybody in China that their way was better, that everybody should be communists. And the people eventually said, well, we'd rather do that than probably have another kind of dictatorial guy, General Shek, who is really nothing more than maybe another kind of dictator that we don't want. They honestly believe that they would have a true democracy. I know that's hard to believe, because we don't think of communism as being democratic. And they even created a democratic kind of constitution, not too different in some ways from the constitution that we have here in the United States, for those of you who live in the United States and who can hear my voice. So that's a pretty good thing, if you think about it, that's where they were coming from, at least in their rhetoric. One of the problems about rhetoric is that it can be awfully untrue. And this was what I think was going on throughout the late 40s, as the communist Chinese were looking for ways to gain power in their country. Mao Zedong, the guy who you probably heard a lot about, he was really smarter than most of the other political leaders of his time. That's scary, isn't it? He was smarter. And he actually was capable of pulling off a great scheme. The scheme was, he created a pretty darn good constitution. He was better as a general than his opponents and in military strategy. And he was good at kind of one-liners, you could call it. Like, you should do this, we should do that kind of thing. And he even wrote down eventually in a book all these one-liners that people started to follow, almost like a religion. And he also was, as Marx and Engels were, basically an atheist. He said, you know what? All this nonsense about God, what did it get for the Chinese people? Nothing. We need to be more focused on where we're going to be getting our food and how we're going to be living, and I'm going to free up all the masses by getting rid of all the landlords and the rulers on the sub-political level. I'm going to get rid of any emperors or people who are seeking to hobnob with people of social rank or something, which is Shek guy was doing. So basically, he was a populist who also was fairly adept at political maneuvers, at military action, and at lying, propaganda. Now, you can call it propaganda, I'll call it lying. And he actually learned a great deal through World War II, as he saw the Nazis and to some lesser extent the Japanese, although the Japanese affected his country a great deal, lie their butts off telling people things that were just nonsense, crazy things, and being successful at it. And he learned. He wasn't so good in the 30s, but he was way better in the 40s. As we went through World War II, he learned a great deal about this process, and he watched a guy named Stalin in Russia, and he learned a lot from him, too. And what did he learn? He learned that if you want to get people to follow you, you tell them what they want to hear and make them do what you want them to do. And you forget about anything in between. And it was a pretty effective system, more effective than Stalin was. Because Stalin was paranoid and crazy, and he killed about 20 million of his people because he was afraid one of them might be trying to kill him. Very bad odds, actually. And at any rate, the whole process here, if we look at what was going on in communist China in the late 40s, it was one of the most contrived and brilliant plots to in a dark way, that means dark side, evil, bad things, to take over one of the largest countries in population, if not the largest, on Earth, where people have been subjected through Japanese control for a long time. You know, we're talking like 15 years the Japanese were in control of China in one way or another, killing them, destroying them. The people are ready for anything, and especially a guy who says, hey, I'm getting rid of all the dictators. I'm getting rid of all the bad people that have been taking from you. You people are all going to be in charge. And we're going to do this by a collective method, and we're all going to work together and love each other, you know, kumbaya and everything else. And isn't this wonderful? Of course, behind the scenes, his determination was to become the most ruthless, most dictatorial, most evil person ever in the history of the world. Now, is that sound over the top? You're going to say, oh, what, Stalin was worse, Hitler was worse. What about all those bad people during the Dark Ages? And what about the terrible Huns and all these other people? They were worse, weren't they? Not really. Because to me, evil is the guy who stabs you in the back while he's patting you on the head and smiling at you. And that certainly wasn't the terrible Huns. They didn't pat anybody. They just came after you. You know, if you don't want to be Hunified, then you give them everything they want, and that maybe they'll let you be. That wasn't his method at all. And Hitler. Well, Hitler was pretty evil. No question about it. And remember that this guy, wow, he was learning from evil. I'm learning from Hitler as well as the seven others that Hitler ran around with that were running his government. He was learning from these eight jerks. But it wasn't, Hitler was still mired in too much of the European form of taking charge by using more traditional methods of, we'll say, forcing people to do certain things while making it look like you're not, etc. That wasn't Mao's method. Mao's method was something entirely different. He completely convinced, he mostly convinced the majority, the vast majority of the communist people that his way was right, and they said, Mao's for me. He didn't go in and shoot him. Everybody thinks he did. He did later. But in the beginning, I mean, this guy took over just by smiling and say, hey, I got all these great sayings. There's no more than 20 words in any one of them, and every one is a way for you to improve your life and live. And you don't even have to go to school anymore. Forget about culture. Forget about learning anything about even science. All you have to do is just learn these phrases and follow me, and we're all going to be sitting in the best situation possible, and I will turn this country into everything you ever wanted. You write down your wish list of the 10 things you want the most, and I can make sure you get 9 of them next year. And people said, oh, yeah, I want that. Because they'd had such terrible, terrible times The Japanese were ruthless on the Chinese. They killed people for no reason. They killed them for sport. And they took everything they had. I mean, this was a terribly upset country. We tend to think that we took the brunt of World War II. Well, actually, the Chinese were in World War II like 8 years before we were, before any, virtually 6-7 years before anybody else was. They were in World War II because the Japanese, who was the ally of Germany, had an out room. They figured, oh, those Chinese, let's go take everything they got, and then we'll do some more. So long before we were attacked, the United States was attacked by the Japanese in Pearl Harbor, they had already done much worse than that in China. And, you know, a few Americans actually went and fought in China and tried to help these people. But unfortunately, it just didn't make enough of a mark. Because as the war drew down, we made huge mistakes in the way that we politically dealt with China, with Russia, with Soviet Union, with all these countries. We made huge mistakes. And we opened the door for this kind of stuff to go on. Okay, so Mao was the genius. Mao is the great genius who is really an evil turkey. But for a lot of people, they thought he was a wonderful guy, and some people still today say so. Even people who are spiritual and even practice and claim they teach ageless wisdom think Mao was a wonderful guy. He was so wonderful. Instead of killing 20 million people like Stalin, or, well, I guess if you look at all the people that Hitler killed, it was 49 million or something like that. Or the Japanese, they knocked off 34 million, whatever it is. Instead of doing that, that's pittance. This guy took out 400 million people. That's an estimate. Yeah. Now, he didn't do it just by military methods. He did it by starvation. He did it by reducing people's capacity to do the most simple things. He did it by no health care. He did it by a lack of any kind of reasonable education. He did it by literally keeping people in the worst circumstances. Something on the order of about 400 million people. During his entire life, he may have bumped off. Man, you could take all the people together that were killed during World War II, and it isn't that much. That's a lot of people for one guy to do. And I kind of use that as a measure for how evil someone is. It's kind of a broad stroke measure. I realize there are other things you can consider, but he certainly falls into that category. Okay. So, where does that leave us? Well, Mao looked over and said, where can I go next to do my destruction? Because I've already got most of what was then considered to be China. But there's all these other countries that are surrounding China, particularly to the west and the north, and they're in mountainous areas. People don't know much about them. I'll just grab them too. You know, what the heck? Because if nobody's going to stop me, I'm just going to keep doing my thing, which is to take over. So about 49, he's sending out messengers to the Tibetan people and saying to the leaders, the Kolans, they're called leaders of their cabinet-like people in Tibet. And he's saying, hey, you guys, you know what? Time for you to join back with us. They're saying, huh? What are you talking about? We're Tibetans. You're Chinese. We're neighbors. We're friends. But we've never been part of you. And he says, oh, yeah. You were part of us. If you go back in history, you know, we used to come over there, and we actually did things that made us look like your leaders. And the Tibetans kind of scratched their head, and so did a few other countries, like Nepal, et cetera, and said, wait a second. We've never been part of China, and we don't want to be part of China. Thank you very much. And then Mao said, but you know, you've got to be part of China. Because we're bigger than you. And if you don't agree, very bad things could happen to you. You know, we would want that to happen. We don't want that to happen, but you need to really change your mind here. But we've got a great constitution, and our constitution says that if you voluntarily join with us, since you used to be part of China, I swear that's what this constitution says, that you have all the rights of being a Chinese citizen. Isn't that a good thing? And what we'll do is we'll convey these rights on you, which will give you autonomous, independent authority, and you still can call yourself Tibetans or Nepalese or whatever you want to call yourself, and you can practice this religion that you have called Buddhism, which we, you know, we don't believe in religion, but we'll let you do that because we're so magnanimous. We truly are. And if you just meet with us, we'll put some accords in place that guarantee that you will be part of our constitution and our government, and we will respect these things, and you'll just be pleased as punch because we're going to share with you some of our technology. We're going to protect you from anybody who might come in and do bad things to you. You know, it's still a bad world out there. And we're going to make your life better, and we aren't going to take anything from you. As a matter of fact, we won't even tax you unless you agree to it first. How's that for a government? And you know, the Tibetans said, maybe we should just go along with this. And I'll tell you more about this when we get back. But I'm going to tell you right now, the rest of it is not going to be as friendly as what I just told you. And unfortunately, we're going to really hear about some serious problems that have gone on and some solutions, particularly one that I'm going to suggest specifically. So we'll be back in about 2.5, oh no, I take that back, about 3.5 minutes, something like that. You know, it's really interesting being on this station because sometimes we kind of make it up as we go along. So that's what we're doing right now. We have a new sponsor tonight. I want to say hello, new sponsor. Thank you for sponsoring this show. We always love that. And at any rate, you'll hear about that when we come back from our break.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Well, we're back, and this is, again, Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. That commercial I told you about, they're looking for it. It seems to be somewhere. And it may run right after we get off the air. For this will be the only time that will happen, because, you know, it's a new commercial, and somehow it got put someplace, and nobody knows exactly where it is. But like I said, this is like live radio. That happens. You know, lots of things happen. But, you know, that's the name of the game. I've been doing this thing for, I guess, on to 5 years now, and a lot of different things have gone on, believe it or not. All right, so let me continue with what we're talking about. And for those of you just tuning in, it's the crisis in Tibet. And it's about more than just Tibet. I want to now expand this out. I want you to think about this in terms of this is really a world crisis, and you'll start seeing how it starts fitting into that parameter as they come up with some solutions or a solution. And also as you can see how this is really working out. Okay, so let me continue with my historical story. I hope you're not getting upset if I'm saying some things that may not exactly fit what you think actually happened, but certainly you can call in and say something different if you think so. Okay, so in 1950, the leaders, including the Dalai Lama, get together with the Chinese leaders, including Mao. And they all get together, and Mao is selling this this business about their constitution will now include the Tibetan people, and the Tibetan people will be considered Chinese. Now, the Tibetans would not agree that Tibet was always part of China, and it just happens to be that they forgot that, because they decided that that would be ridiculous, because they didn't forget it. They've remembered, and they know that they've been Tibetans, and that they've followed a tradition of having a certain type of culture. But they did agree to join the Chinese, because they figured Tibet would ensue a war that they couldn't win, and that may not make any difference anyway, since the Chinese are saying you're going to have complete autonomy or almost complete autonomy. We're not going to interfere in the internal affairs of Tibet. You guys do whatever you've been doing. It's just that we have a new handshake. Instead of being neighbors, we're one in the same. And, you know, this kind of fit the Tibetans' philosophy. They said, and that's what Mao was such a genius at. He created agreements with people based upon their philosophies. And he said, gee, we're all one, aren't we? That's what you're teaching. And we believe in virtues. We don't believe in God, but we believe in the virtues of God. And one of those virtues is to have compassion for and help everybody you can who lives around you. And not just because they speak a different language or because they don't follow your religion. You don't exclude them. You should include them. Include them. Inclusiveness is the name of the game. So Mao was Mr. Inclusiveness when he met with the Dalai Lama and his ministers and advisors. And they came up with this plan called the 17-point plan. Now, what was that? It's called the 17 Accords. Well, Accords means I'm going to get along with. That's literally what the word means, the 17 ways of getting along. Okay, and those 17 ways of getting along included everything I've said so far, and much more, much more. The Chinese gave the Tibetans all kinds of accords, ways to get along, that they would do, that the Tibetans would do, and everybody was going to be just lovey-dovey. It was terrific. But remember what I said about Mao, biggest liar on the planet. Never wrote a thing, never said a thing that was in any way close to being true, and never kept any agreements. Evil. Yeah, that's who he is. And the Tibetans were the exact opposite. Everything they ever agreed to, they kept. Everything they ever, any agreement they made, they adhered to, even when the other people would break the agreements, and Mao knew this. He loved it. Says, boy, are these people stupid. I'm going to make all these agreements with them. I'm going to break them, and they're going to keep them. I can't believe how simple this is. I should be able to take over the whole world if everybody was just a Tibetan. He was going to go on a campaign to make Tibet the world religion because it would be the easiest way for him to take over the whole planet. I mean, this guy loved the Tibetans because they were so gullible and ridiculous in their desire to adhere to whatever agreement they made, no matter what the other side did. Yes, I'm telling you the truth. Now, that may not be flattering to Tibetan Buddhism or to Tibetan people, but it is the truth. Oh, I think somebody's calling in right now. Hello.
Hi.
Hi, who is this?
My name is Casey.
Say your name again.
My name is Casey.
Casey?
Yes.
Hi, Casey. How you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And did I say anything that upset you, or did I say some things that you may agree with? Or neither?
No, you said things that I agree with. That's why I was wondering, just in dealing with these things, how I was going to ask, you know, how have you learned to be able to not worry? Is that just coming with experience of
not
having
worry?
To worry about...
Well, I'm terribly worried, but I have a solution for this whole plan, or a plan that has a solution within it of how to deal with this situation, but I haven't quite got there yet. But what do you think about it? You tell me what you think is going on in Tibet and elsewhere, and anything you want to say. Go ahead.
Oh, you know what I was looking at was I just felt like there was a lot of problems that were occurring, and it made me sad when you were telling me stories, because I don't ever watch the news or anything like that because of how the only news I do get is from this radio station and the ones that I listen to on the internet. And so when I was listening, I was getting very saddened by the fact that, you know, that I get excited because I do feel that the Buddhist belief system can really assist people, but I was wondering about, like, with dealing with all of that, is it easier to do in our society, considering that it's a lot different, the way we handle things and the way our society is?
We have a lot to learn from the Buddhists, but they also need to learn maybe something from us as well.
Right.
I think, and they would agree with that probably. I think that what we need to be looking at is how to deal with the dark side that this planet has existent on it. And if we continue to ignore that there are people who really want to do us harm, then we may deserve the worst that may happen to us. So that's a great concern I have. And that's kind of the story I'm telling right now about Tibet if we go back to the 1950s. Not today so much, because I'm going to talk about the statement by the Dalai Lama on Monday of this week. And his statements to the press, which were even more profound than his written statement, in which he said, you know, the ways that we've been doing were wrong. The path we've been taking, which is called the middle path, they have a name for it, which I'll explain later, was wrong. And we've made terrible mistakes in how we have politically handled ourselves with the communist Chinese. But at any rate, I'm glad you're listening, and I hope you continue to listen till the end of the show. I don't know if I'm even going to get through this show, but if I don't, I'll continue next week with it. But would you please stay tuned in, and you can contact me after the show as well.
And can't wait
for
Monday.
Thanks. And I'm going to continue to go on now. All right, let me continue on with this scenario. I can't give you too much more of the historical stuff, but I'm going to very quickly tell you what happened. Of course, for the next 9 years, the communist Chinese sent military groups into Tibet, which was against the accords. The accords said no military people would enter Tibet for the sake of squelching or ruling Tibet. Instead, they did the exact opposite. They sent battalions, huge numbers of military people, including equipment, into Tibet. They then took over every city. They started to burn down monasteries and nunneries. They started to imprison and kill monks and nuns. and even rape some nuns. They destroyed countless historical, going back hundreds of years, historical, we'll say, significant elements of the Tibetan religion. I don't know what they have names for these things. I don't know their names in Tibetan, but they destroyed these things. And then they went on and they took over completely every element of their society, including all elements of what the government was doing. And they subjected these poor people to the most severe kinds of treatment. So much so that in 1959, there was a spontaneous rebellion, but nonviolent, on the part of the Tibetans. Because every accord had been broken, the Dalai Lama had gone and said, "You're breaking all the accords." And Mao just laughed, said, "Yeah, how about that?" And but the Dalai Lama said, "But why aren't you keeping them? We're good people. You should be good, and we should all be good together." It didn't work. So then the Dalai Lama finally realized that he was going to be probably put to death if he stayed. So he left, and about 100,000 people over the next year left with him, and he went to northern India, and he was in exile. But he decided that he would continue to negotiate with the Chinese, because after all, they made this deal with him, the 17 Accords, and they should keep it, right? Because he was keeping it. Even while everybody was dying and being killed, they still kept the accords. They actually kept them. They didn't take up arms. That was one of the things that the accords said that they weren't to do. They did not ask for help from an outside political source, like another country, like the U.S. or something, to come in and push the Chinese out or whatever. They didn't do that. They didn't form any kind of alliances or anything that was against Chinese communism. They did, or they kept everything. And Mao loved it. While he started to take away all of their trees and kill all of their animals and destroy everything he could that was of Tibet in the land itself, while he killed all the people and wiped out the religion. After Mao left, Mao said, "Hey, if you're leaving, I'm putting in my own Dalai Lama." And that's what he did, as I said earlier in the show. That's what went on. And then the Dalai Lama and his advisors, along with some of the people of Tibet, decided that they would try this thing called the Middle Way. The Middle Way was to try to give as much as they could to appease the Chinese in their ways. Whatever they wanted, they would try to give them, and still maintain their integrity as being Tibet. So the Chinese said, "Sure, what else would you like to give us?" And so they came up with 20 or 30 different things they would give them, and the Chinese said, "Thank you very much," and Mao laughed some more, and went in and killed some more monks, just for the heck of it, and took over and destroyed some more monasteries, just for the heck of it. And this went on for decades, and the Tibetans kept doing it for decades. More Middle Way stuff. After all, the Middle Way was supposed to be the teachings of Buddha. Okay, we got somebody else on the line. Hi. Hello.
Hi, Ron. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Ron, I have a question. Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
My question is this, that if you're ascending to be a light being and you see different girls, and if you'd want to get married, this would be a parasitic reunion back and forth if you get married, and this would be not advisable if you'd want to continue to be a light being and be free of the entities. Is that right?
I think you might be on the wrong show. I think they have more than one show going on in this station, and what show are you trying to connect with?
The Light Ship, Light Ship Healing.
Right, that's not this show. Somehow they got us mixed up. Try calling back, and they'll hook you into the right channel.
Okay.
Thanks for calling,
you.
Though. Okay. Wait, like I said, live radio, it's lots of fun, and things can happen. You just don't know what's going to be next. Okay. Who knows? Maybe I'll get called by somebody who's calling some station on the East Coast. I don't know. That's possible. At any rate, let me continue on. So here we are, and we finally reached the point, and I'm going to tell you this. We're going to run out of time here. I wish we weren't, but we finally reach a point where the Dalai Lama is saying, hey, you know what? I screwed up. This middle way business never worked. You can't appease a hungry tiger whose only thought is to devour you. He didn't say that, but I think that would mimic most of what he was intending to say. And it's like an impossible situation. The more you give, the more they take, the more they destroy, the more they kill, the more they want. Because they're evil. And this is where the problem is, that it's not fully recognized what evil is and what it does, even by, unfortunately, some of the wisest of people in the Tibetan religion. All right, so my suggestion. What is the suggestion? My suggestion was forth at some meetings about 25 years ago, and I've since then have taught it several times, numerous times, actually, especially for the 10 years following that. So from about 1985 to about 1995, I made some suggestions. I also sent the Dalai Lama a copy of my textbook, which he acknowledged receiving, in 2000, the early spring of 2000. And during that time, I was espousing the following, that let's forget about trying to appease evil dictators, and after there was Mao, there was more, and there never will be an end. And let's forget about 17 accords that you agreed to from 1950, which just ain't going to happen, okay? And let's instead look at how we survive and get ourselves out of this dilemma that we have put ourselves into. After all, we agreed, accord. That means we agreed to this crazy scenario of being raped, destroyed, annihilated, genocided, religiosized, whatever. We agreed to it. So there's got to be some solution, and there is a solution. Evil seeks to control people and destroy people. The land that it gets is only a chip in the bargain. It doesn't matter to evil. Land itself is of no value if you can't subject the people and enslave them and torture them and take from them. It's the people you want. So what I suggested in 1995 and from that point forward is that the Tibetan people, as many as choose to, some may choose not to, get the heck out of Tibet and let the Chinese have it. It's your country. You own it. You got the Constitution that says it's yours. Goodbye. Mass exodus. I'm talking like on the order of Moses. Get those people out. Have them get out whatever way they possibly can. If you can do it in some organized way, fine. If you can't, just everybody that can get out, go. One good thing about Tibet is it has very difficult borders to defend. You can get out of that country if you want to, because it's so mountainous and there's so many different ways to get around. If you got to be able to climb, you got to be able to do certain things, but you can get around. You can do it. And besides which, in actuality, there's never been any statement that you can't. In a weird way, the Chinese always assumed that the Tibetans were so foolish, they're just going to stay around anyway, no matter what we do to them. We'll kill them, we'll torture them, and they'll still stay. Well, I'm saying, if you're the leader of Tibet, you let your people know it's time to go, but not to join you in North India, but rather to join you in a negotiated agreement with another country that needs the Tibetan people to help them to rebuild their country. A disadvantaged country, a country that may be swamped with disease and plagued by other issues, that has no economic worth to speak of, and who needs the kind of metal that the Tibetans are made out of, to join together in a coalition and to be allowed to continue its practice of religion while the Tibetans practice theirs, and they work together to build new Tibet. It could be on the other side of the planet. It could be at the South Pole. I don't care where it is. as long as it's someplace that these people are away from the worst kind of evil in this world, which is the Chinese government. Not the Chinese people. I'm talking about a regime. A regime set to destroy them. That's what that regime is trying to do. It's trying to destroy a lot of other things, too. But it certainly is trying to destroy the Tibetan people. And you need to get away from that, because if you don't, you're going to get destroyed. I mean, you don't have any way of defending yourself against these kinds of monsters. If you stay, you die. Or you wish you had died. So why? You came to incarnate in a physical world to do good in this world. Now, it's the part, this is the part I'm not going to have time to talk about. It isn't just doing it for yourselves that will succeed. My complete plan is not going to be successful unless it's done for right motive. And the right motive is to bring to the world a new kind of country that is the exemplar of all the things that the Tibetan Buddhist religion practices, but without being a Buddhist religious practice, rather being a democratic kind of new type of country. Something so new that it will allow other countries that are democracies to learn something from, and to also learn about the evil. Because the evil has been kept hidden by the Tibetans willing to subject themselves to this kind of cruelty. It's actually allowed it to stay hidden. When they all leave and become something greater, they can unhide it by allowing others to understand and to see that these people were great people that could be much more than they are. This is the plan. Now, I'm going to have to talk more about it next week because I'm out of time. I know. It just goes that way. Sometimes. I would love to tell you so much more about this and how it would do so good for our world to have this plan enacted and at the same time save the people of Tibet, which we want to do, I want to do. But you got to admit to what's really going on and do something to correct it and not sit around and say, well, we have our 17 accords. You got to do something that is going to legitimately take action, because it is right action that is needed besides the belief and the practicing of virtue. Right action means that sometimes you have to literally make some severe changes and give up, quote unquote, having your land, having those mountains, which are so beautiful, having a way of life, because that way of life now is torture, it's destruction, and it's servitude. That's what's left of the Tibetan way of life. So you either leave that, or you get what you choose to have. There are no other choices. None are left. And this is my message for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. I sent him this message with a lot more information 2 days ago. And I alone did not send it to him, but the spiritual group I'm part of did. But it was a message that came from teachings from me from the mid-80s on. And hopefully he will hear them. So we're out of time for right now. I'm not even going to make any other announcements in case we have a commercial to give or so. And we will be back talking more about this next week. So please tune in, because I'll just call it the Crisis in Tibet 2 for next Friday, because I didn't really get to all the things I wanted to talk about. So until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.
Imagine for a moment that you are transported back to 1909, 100 years ago, but you retain your memory of all the advances which occurred in 100 years. Airplanes, cell phones, the internet, TV, space travel. Now, come back to 2009. Do you think progress will stop? What will be the most significant happening of the next 100 years? Leo Kim's book, Healing the Rift, Bridging the Gap Between Science and Spirituality, will reveal to you the new scientific revolution, and the power of the mind, wirelessly connected to the universe, will be the event which changes our world by healing many rifts and by changing our lives. Progress will not stop, and neither will you. Get Leo Kim's book at Amazon.com or visit HealingTheRiftBook.com.